From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series on young people and the epidemic of violence in America. Jeffrey Canada had to learn to defend himself against violence as a child. Now he teaches young people how to avoid violence in neighborhoods where violence seems inescapable. He heads the Reedland Centers in Harlem, a program of schools and community centers providing safe havens for children. He's written a memoir he describes as a personal history of violence in America. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the architects of the New Orleans sound, Dave Bartholomew. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations says it has concluded, beyond all reasonable doubt, that the Bosnian Serbs were responsible for yesterday's mortar attack on Sarajevo. At least 37 people were killed and more than 80 were wounded. The UN says it's reviewing options for a response and has not ruled out airstrikes. The BBC's Martin Dawes reports from Sarajevo.
Alexandra Vanko of UNPROFOR declared that yesterday's mortar bombing was unprovoked and barbaric. He said the circumstantial and technical evidence was overwhelming. Sources say a response is still being considered. A United Nations official has let it be known that any air action would be massive, as NATO jets would first have to knock out Bosnian Serb air defence systems before moving on to other targets. Using the guns of the Rapid Reaction Force, which are deployed around Sarajevo, is another option, as is no response. But that would further undermine the credibility of the international effort in Bosnia. In the meantime, orders have gone out to UNPROFOR troops telling them not to attempt to cross Bosnian Serb-held territory.
Martin Dawes reporting. A bomb blew up the car in the motorcade of Georgian President Edward Shevardnadze. He was going to sign a new constitution for his republic. Shevardnadze was not seriously hurt, but his aides are calling this an assassination attempt. They say the Georgian leader was hit by flying glass. TV footage afterwards showed him at a hospital, sitting in his undershirt with cuts on his face. There appeared to be no serious injuries. The UN Security Council has ordered a full investigation into the assassination 2 years ago of Burundi's first freely elected president. His death set off waves of ethnic violence. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Burundi is torn by the same Hutu-Tutsi conflict as neighboring Rwanda, but 2 years ago, Burundi seemed on the way to peaceful coexistence between the two groups. Long dominated by the Tutsi minority, Burundi held its first free election in 1993. The majority voted in Melchior Ndadaye, a Hutu president, and both groups shared power in the new government. But months later, the president was killed in a coup attempt by officers in the Tutsi-dominated military. The Hutu majority felt betrayed and lashed out. Tens of thousands died in the resulting violence, and the country has been racked by fighting ever since. No one was ever tried or punished for the assassination or the subsequent violence. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
President Clinton's Whitewater business partner pleaded innocent to federal charges of conspiracy today with a former judge who accused Mr. Clinton of pressuring him to make shady loans. James McDougal was arraigned on 19 counts in a federal indictment, then also named his ex-wife Susan and Governor Jim Guy Tucker. Tucker has pleaded innocent to 11 counts. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 10 points at 4,600.04. This is NPR. The Chinese government says it'll allow demonstrations during the United Nations Conference on Women, but at only one designated spot 30 miles out of Beijing, and provided that the demonstrators do not attack China. Chinese rumors indicate some women plan to protest in the nude in city streets. Beijing police have stocked up on blankets, bathrobes, sheets, and rubber gloves as a precaution. Women who object to the demonstration location can submit requests to local police, but organizers expect those requests to be denied. The House Banking Committee may hold hearings later this year on major bank mergers. Committee Chairwoman, New Jersey Republican Marge Rockema, says it is important to conduct oversight hearings to ensure the law is being carried out properly. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The banking committee plans to conduct the hearings in October to determine how the wave of big bank mergers will affect consumers. The hearings are expected to focus on issues ranging from antitrust regulations to basic consumer protection laws. A House aide says concerns have been raised that these mega mergers might not be consumer-friendly. Representative Rokema says the recent merger and acquisition activity is already giving us a partial indication of what the structure of the banking industry is going to look like in the future. She says the subcommittee will oversee the implementation of the new interstate banking law, especially in light of the spate of large mergers. The law allows a bank holding company to acquire a bank in any state starting September 29th, preempting any state law to the contrary. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A research group says if U.S. schools are to improve, changes must come from the top. A panel organized at Columbia University Teachers College says good teaching techniques are well known, but there's no national clarity of goals. The group suggests that schools adopt productivity lessons from the business world so that they can do a better job without spending more money. Goals include cuts in administration. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our series on young people and the epidemic of violence in America. Jeffrey Canada calls the young people he works with the handgun generation, a generation of children growing up under the conditions of war, a war that doesn't end. Violence is nothing new, he says, but violence in our inner cities is getting worse because there are too many guns, too much crack, too few jobs, too little hope. Canada has worked with poor inner-city children for about 20 years. He's the president of the Riedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, a program of schools and community centers providing safe havens for children. Canada teaches children to avoid violence. He also teaches them self-defense through his martial arts classes. Canada grew up in the South Bronx. He's written a new book which he describes as a personal history of violence in America called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. Earlier this summer, he told me guns in the hands of children are even more dangerous than guns in the hands of professional criminals.
The problem with young people with guns is that, A, they're impulsive. Two, they tend to panic and shoot wildly. Three, most of them have never shot a gun really at a target before, so anyone who's close by is liable to get shot. And four is, you know, one of the things that happens is they get so angry so quickly. And then if you were to talk to them 2 hours later, they're not angry anymore. They're not that angry anymore. So this impulsivity means that they often will come out and shoot first and think later. What it's led to is really something which is even worse than many of the movies, the Western movies many of us grew up with, where you had the quick draw. You know, this is no longer stand in the street and, you know, count to three and draw. It's find a gun, pull it out and shoot the person. Hopefully when they don't know you're coming, and they have no opportunity to defend themselves. And what's even more frightening is young people have learned to really shoot in the head and upper parts of the body now because so many young people started wearing bulletproof vests. So the lethality of violence right now is really escalating to the point now that most young people who are shot by guns end up really being paralyzed or severely injured if they're not killed.
You really teach your kids self-defense, and you also try to teach them what to do if someone is trying to hurt them. You sometimes ask this multiple choice question. When someone points a gun in your direction but doesn't want to shoot you in particular, you should A, run into the nearest building, B, yell and scream while you run away, C, stand still, D, hit the ground. What's the correct answer?
Well, you know, the correct answer to this question is really D, and it's...
Hit the ground.
Hit the ground. And you know, it's really a shame. Young people really are not taught how to survive gunshots. And everybody else, every other military person knows when someone's shooting at you, you automatically hit the ground. And it presents the most difficult target. It prevents you from accidentally getting shot. It's really very difficult for someone to be shooting at somebody and accidentally hit you if you're on the ground. But unfortunately, young people don't know this, you know, and I learned this, unfortunately, the hard way in the South Bronx when someone was pointing a gun in my direction when I was playing checkers on a street corner. And I did the crazy thing and I ran right into someone else who had a gun out and thinking this person was coming. And it's just a miracle that I wasn't shot. And one of the older guys on the block told me, you know, in the way older guys talk to young guys, you know, you're so stupid. Why didn't you hit the ground like everybody else? And I thought, well, you know, no one had ever told me that. How would you expect, you know, a young kid to know that that's what you're supposed to do? Constantly, what you find when you hear gunshots are children running and screaming, which poses really two real problems. One is that many of those children end up getting shot in the back by stray bullets that miss their target. The second thing, it ends up with lots of kids end up getting trampled as they really run for an exit. We have to teach young people really what to do. And it sounds so terrible to think that we have to teach young people how to hit the ground when they hear shots. But it is the only way that we know that on the street corners of our city that kids will survive when people come by randomly shooting guns. And of course, the real issue is that we need to get our kids off of those street corners. But at the same time, kids are so exposed to violence and guns these days that it's something that every parent ought to spend time telling children. Because I'll tell you this, the sound of a gun is so loud and so terrifying that if no one's ever really told you what to do, you're going to simply panic.
Well, your instincts are, get away.
Get away and run. And usually you run right where everybody else is running. And usually that's where the person they're aiming at is running at the same time.
You teach taekwondo, which is a form of martial arts. It's a Korean karate. How does martial arts help children with avoiding violence, which is your ultimate aim here?
Well, you know, it's so wonderful. I have these young people who come to me, and many of them come because, you know, there's somebody bothering them, and they're really looking for a way, you know, to beat this person up. And they say, you know, here's a person who could teach me how to, you know, go back and get revenge. And it's always, they're so disappointed because they come to me, and all of them want to ask this one question. And they call me Sensei, and they say, Sensei, have you ever had to fight with karate? And I tell them no. And they're all so disappointed. They're like, oh, because they wanted to hear these stories, how I disarmed these people, or I beat up six or seven people. But I tell them that's the art. The art is, can you figure out a way to avoid violence? That's really what we're trying to teach. And they don't get it right away. But after a while, it becomes clearer and clearer to them the ramifications of violence are. And especially in a handgun generation, where if people thought you knew martial arts, they would shoot you immediately. Takes a while before the young people really find out.
Well, that's the thing. How useful is martial arts against guns?
It is totally useless. It is totally useless. And yet all of my students, they love the discipline of doing martial arts, even though they know there's zero possibility that they're going to probably end up defending themselves with this. But I'll tell you a little story which will demonstrate some of what I have to deal with in terms of martial arts. Now, I was giving one of my standard speeches last Monday to a group of my students about how they can't use violence, and anybody found using the martial arts, it's not a self-defense situation, and we define that when you cannot run away and you are trapped. That is self-defense. You have no way to avoid the situation. That's self-defense. So I'm going through this explanation, and after class, this kid, he's about 7, he comes over to me and he says, Sensei, there's this other student who's 9, right? So now we've got this big age difference, and so he's really justifying why I have to get involved. He says, and, you know, he comes every day. He comes and he says things to me, and he bullies me around, and he's also a martial arts student. He's a more senior-ranking belt than I am, and I just don't know what to do. And I looked at him, and I know what he wanted me to say was, you know, I'll come to school, and, you know, I'll go and talk to the kid. And I told him, you know, every time that happens to you, I want you to go home, and I want you to do 15 push-ups. And the kid looked at me. I said, that's right. I want you to think that this young person who comes in, every time he bothers you, he's giving you incentive to do 15 push-ups. I said, now you do those 15 push-ups, in about a year, you're going to be so strong that no one's going to bother you. And this kid's eyes lit up because he thought, you know, this might actually make some sense. I mean, if I use this disadvantage situation to my advantage, maybe I can avoid this. And it was a way, again, of avoiding a young person thinking the solution is, let me get someone more violent, more powerful to come and beat this other kid up. How can you turn that situation to your advantage so that you don't have to act violently, but again, can escape the violent situation?
Well, it's always seemed to me that in neighborhoods where people fight, that in order not to fight, you need to be strong enough to fight and win in order to walk away. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're strong enough to have fought and won, had you chosen to fought, then you can maybe walk away and still be respected. But if you're not physically strong and you walk away, you'll just be seen as a coward, too weak to fight.
And this is the issue of becoming a victim. And this is really what children are really the most afraid of. And it really means so many children act so violently because what they're interpreting is everything I do, if someone thinks it makes me look weak, then I'll become a victim and everyone will pick on me. So one of the things we teach young people is how to be aggressive in saying, I don't want to fight. not in a way that edges on a fight, but at the same time takes a step away from a person and looks them right in their eye in a way that cowards won't do and say, no, I'm not interested in fighting you. If you do that correctly, and it's a very complicated skill because it's very subtle, you can avoid most of that violence. But there's this other issue. It not only takes a certain amount of physical preparation, and so we give young people that, and it actually, when you're physically strong, you actually feel more confidence, and you exude this confidence that other young people realize means that you really could defend yourself. But there's a certain mental toughness that comes along with this also. And so it is building up the physical and the mental at the same time that I think is so important for young people.
Jeffrey Canada is my guest. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem and the author of the new memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jeffrey Canada, president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, and the author of the new memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. You tell the story in your memoir about how your mother basically taught the boys in the family that they'd better learn how to fight. One of your brother's jackets was stolen, and the older brother was basically told by your mother, you go back to the kid who stole the jacket and you get it back, or else I'm going to give you a beating.
This is something that I think that when I talk to many parents today of young people, this is this issue again of children being victimized. You know, my mother was a single mother. She had four boys, and her terror was that she would not be able to raise her boys so that we could really survive in the tough streets of the South Bronx. So she really looked for signs that looked like we were becoming victims on the street. And in this one particular time, I was too young to go in the streets, and my two brothers were out in the playground right down a block from us. And my brother John's coat was taken down. It was only a year separating my brother Dan from my brother John. And when John came back to the house and told my mother, you know, the boys took my coat, she looked right at my brother Dan and said, you let the boy take your coat? And all of us looked like, well, what could Dan do about this? And what is his role in this whole thing? And she told Dan, you're going to go back and you're going to get that coat. And Dan tried to protest, and we found out she was not hearing anything about protesting going to get that coat. Now, and Dan, when Dan didn't want to go, she told him, I'm going to beat you worse than this kid could ever beat you. And she meant it. And we were all stunned. And Dan had to go out, and, you know, he went and he got that coat, brought it back. And we all learned a lesson that day about really, and I tell people, you know, my lesson was that as a young person, a little younger than them, that you shouldn't tell your mother, you know, when something was stolen, tell her it was lost. That was a better way. But we learned that, you know, we were really going to have to defend ourselves in the street, and we weren't going to be able to come and get our mother to fight our battles. Now, the problem with this kind of thinking is that while many parents, and I myself ended up doing the same thing, years later, when I was an adult and my own daughter was in kindergarten and came home with her face scratched up, and no one would help me at the school, and I felt so desperate that this my little girl had gotten scratched up by another girl and no one in the school would help me, that I told my daughter, you know, you better not let anybody else do this, and I taught her how to defend herself.
What's wrong with it?
The problem with this is that it escalates. It just keeps escalating. And after a while, children begin to pick up bottles and children begin to pick up sticks. And really, we need the schools and other institutions to respond to parents' concerns for their children's safety. And all of our parents have to stop teaching kids to act violently. Now, at the same time, if you live in a very violent environment, and many of our parents do, and you can't be with your child all the time, you don't want your child constantly having their clothing and other articles taken from them. So it calls for really a community-wide response around this issue of violence. But it is a very dangerous thing. Because once you teach a child to act violent, there's really no more checks on that. You can't suddenly say, okay, now I taught you to act violent, but now I don't want you to act violent anymore now. You've gotten too big or something like that. Children just learn to act more and more violently over time.
You know, I know you've tried to make your schools and your centers safe havens. What does it take to do that? Do you use metal detectors, private security guards? Is that the approach you're taking?
Well, we really try to avoid those kinds of solutions because we don't think, A, that they're cost effective, and B, we don't really think they give a sense to young people of what we really try to stand for in terms of being creating a nonviolent community. And we don't try and be Pollyanna about this whole issue of nonviolence either and pretend that, you know, that we don't live in a very violent society. There are a couple of things that we think are really critical in dealing with this issue of violence. One is we have to identify the places where violence happens, and we have to put adults in those places. Two, we have to look at the corridors that children travel and make sure that there are adults actually looking out for children so that young people know what they can do and who they can turn to if they have a violent interaction. The third is we have to really inform the community that we want to stop this violence from happening. One of the things that we're doing in Central Harlem is we have something we call safety nights. And what a safety night is, one night a month, because we felt it would overwhelm the community if we tried to do it every night or every Friday night. But one night a month, we said, can we keep our children safe in this community when we know most of our children are being hurt? We did the research, talked to the police and the local hospitals. We found out most children in Central Harlem are hurt in the evenings between 5 and 11. Weekends are the worst times. So we said, let's take a Friday night or a Saturday night and see if we can keep all of our children safe for just one night. We have teach-ins. We've been working with the churches and asking them if they would open up their doors and not taking hundreds of kids, but can you take in 10 children? Can you just use the children in that community to form a little safe community for our safety nights? And we think that by informing the community, by organizing the community, it gets not only to the children that we're trying to change the issues of violence in the community, but it also gets to the adults. And they begin to understand that they have a role to play, that's connected with what's happening with children, and we try and reweave some of the fabric of community that many of us think we have lost in lots of our communities.
What about the schools and the community centers? You say you don't want to use the metal detector approach. How do you prevent kids from taking knives and guns into the schools and centers?
We decided that what we really needed to do was make sure that the young people who came to our centers understood that they were sharing this time and this space with other generations. This was not just simply going to be a youth community. The problem is if you create just a teenage youth community, teenagers are risk takers. They like taking risks. They look for the kind of excitement that adolescence often brings. So if they feel like this is totally their environment, they bring a lot of that risk-taking behavior with them to the center. We thought if we bring their mothers and their grandmothers and their younger siblings into this building, chances are they're going to see this as a place where they have to play the role as protector, not as the role of risk taker. So that we've really started programs that are intergenerational. We have parents coming into the center at the same time while our adolescents are there. You know, an adolescent is much less likely to swear up and down the hallway if he thinks his mother or one of his friend's mothers might be turning that corner any moment now. So it really, I think, brought a way of dealing with this issue of violence in a much more naturalized way. Young people in family situations do not act violently under most circumstances if families are mixed together. It also gives us an opportunity to connect adults with young people. There are many adults who live in our community who see every young person standing on the corner as a threat. When they go by, they clutch their handbags, they get really tense. They don't know who these children are. Many of these children are their neighbors. After they come to the center, they begin to form relationships with these young people so that they speak to one another. You know, it actually makes the whole community safer. Now when they're coming home after work and they're walking by this group of kids, you know, they're able to say, you know, how you doing, Ronald? And they say, I'm doing good, Ms. Grant. How are you? And you feel like people are looking out for you in the community. That's the way communities used to function. And we really think that that's the way we can get our communities to function better.
Now, you're doing your best to keep guns out of the hands of children. But you understand why young people sometimes have guns. In fact, you got a gun when you were in college.
You know, it was really, it just, every time I think about that incident, it just reminds me of how young people feel around the issue of needing self-protection. You know, we had grown up on Union Avenue in the South Bronx, and then we moved to a different neighborhood where I didn't know anybody. And, you know, New York has these waves of gangs that come and go. And this was during the early 1970s, and there was a gang movement again over in this part of the Bronx, and suddenly I was coming home. I was in college. I was away at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, the most peaceful, idyllic setting you could ever have a young person in, And when I would come home, there would be these groups of kids, and they were all 15 and 14 and 13. And they were members of a gang, and they were very violent, and they were very scary to me. And I used to go out of my way to make sure that where they were hanging out at, I wouldn't go down that block. I'd walk around a corner, go to a different store. And, you know, a funny thing happened. I was feeling so scared for my personal safety that I bought a handgun, and you could buy them legally up in Maine. And I brought it back to New York, and that gun began to change me.
How did it change you?
What I found was that at first when I would take the gun out with me when I would go to the store, right, and I'd say, just in case those crazy kids, you know, if they jump me, I'll have some self-protection. And I'd go around a corner to the store, and then after a while I started thinking to myself, you know what? Why should I have to go around the corner? I'm not bothering anybody. I mean, after all, that store is close, but I should be able to walk right up that block. So I began to not go around the corner anymore. I began to go directly to the store, which meant I had to walk past the kids, and I would walk on the other side of the street. And then after about a week of carrying that gun, I said to myself, you know what? Why should I have to walk across the street? Why can't I walk down the side of the street, man? If those kids bother me, you know, I'm going to just have to defend myself. And so I'm carrying something, and I began to walk through the street. But now when I walked right by those kids, I used to keep my eyes down and not look at them so I wouldn't cause any antagonism. And then after a while, I said, why should I have to hang my head? Why can't I just walk? Now, you know, without that gun, I would have exercised all of these other mechanisms of safety to keep me safe and out of conflict. But with that gun, it kept saying to me over and over again, why should you have to compromise? Why should you have to, you know, change your ways of acting? Why not just act just the same way you'd want to? And I realized that it wasn't going to be long before I was going to actually put myself in a position where I was going to be challenged. And I wasn't going to back down. I was going to call that challenge out front, and chances are I was going to end up shooting somebody. And that realization really changed me. And I realized I had to get rid of that gun. And then I took it to the dump out in Maine, and I got rid of the handgun. And I've never carried a weapon ever since. But I understand why young people carry guns. There is this sense that you need protection, but it is a funny tool. Once you put that gun in your pocket or you stick it in your pants, you change the way you act. You no longer avoid confrontation. You actually begin to seek out confrontation, and that's what makes these guns so dangerous for young people.
How long did you have yours before you got rid of it?
I had the gun for about maybe 6 or 7 months before I decided I couldn't keep a gun, that I didn't want to live like that, that I knew after a while I would be involved in shooting somebody and possibly murdering somebody.
Did your mother know you had it?
No. No, my mother did not know I had the gun. She would have been extremely upset if she had known I had the gun.
If she found out that you had the gun and she told you to get rid of it before you were ready to get rid of it, would you have kept it or
you know what?
It?
Yeah. I would have kept that gun. And the problem is that you think your parents just simply don't understand. And I would have said, you know, Ma, you're not a man. You don't understand what it feels like. You don't understand how we have to deal with these kind of things. And then that would have been in my mind at 19 years old, 18 years old. That's really how I was thinking. And I find that most young people think that way. And then they think their parents just don't understand what they're going through. They have to have these weapons. Everybody else has them. And if they don't have them, kids are going to pick on them and victimize them. And after all, you know, most of these kids have so much invested in their self-respect, in terms of their ability to walk around and hold their heads up and not to be afraid, that they're willing to die for that. There's really nothing else they possess except what they consider to be their reputation. And if someone damages that, they're really ready to kill or to die for it.
Jeffrey Canada is the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. He's the author of the memoir Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear more from Jeffrey Canada in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, part two of our conversation with Jeffrey Canada on young people and violence. He'll tell us about how his own nephew was shot to death while standing on a street corner. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Dave Bartholomew, one of the creators of the New Orleans sound.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations is trying to decide whether to call in airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs. The UN has determined, beyond all reasonable doubt, that the Serbs were the ones who fired the deadly rocket into the Sarajevo marketplace yesterday, killing 37 people. Another 88 were hurt, most of them children and women. The Serbs had insisted the Bosnian government attacked its own people. The UN says all options for a response are being reviewed. Information recently released by Iraq concerning its secret weapons programs may soon result in the lifting of UN economic sanctions. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
The head of UN's Disarmament Commission on Iraq says Baghdad is close to fully complying with resolutions to dismantle its weapons of mass destruction. Rolf Akeas told the French newspaper Liberation that the UN must still verify the data given by the Iraqis earlier this month about its biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range missile programs. Akeas said, however, that once these questions were resolved, UN resolutions clearly call for a lifting of the 5-year economic embargo against Iraq. His comments conflict with a speech made last week by Madeleine Albright, Washington's ambassador to the UN. She said Iraq was far from having sanctions lifted because the new information it released undermined its credibility. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The human rights group Amnesty International has held its first news conference in Beijing. The group criticized China for executing 16 people before the start of the UN conference on women. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Amnesty International's Secretary General Pierre Sarné says the Chinese government has a grave human rights record and often cleans up before major festivals and other events by arresting and executing what it sees as potential troublemakers. He said the lead-up to the UN Women's Conference has been no exception. Speaking through an interpreter, Chinese government spokesman Chen Jian today denied that the executions had happened and said that Amnesty International members have no business making such statements in Beijing anyway.
Any organization or individuals that will attend this UN conference on women should not make it as an opportunity to interfere in China's internal affairs.
Chen Jian said his government has no plans to discuss the fate of prisoners with Amnesty. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Beijing.
The National Hurricane Center is tracking 4 storms in the Atlantic Ocean, Hurricane Iris, which is closest to land, Hurricane Humberto, which is also expected to move like Iris toward the northeast tomorrow, farther out, Tropical Storm Karen moving west-northwest, and the newest storm, Tropical Storm Luis, which has top sustained winds of 45 miles per hour. On Wall Street, stocks prices were mixed today. The Dow gained more than 14 points to close at 4,608. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR. The French government has officially asked Sweden to extradite a suspect in the recent Paris bombings. France says it has proof linking an Algerian national to the attacks. The Swedish government says it's not sure. Joe Schumann reports.
French police say Abdelkrim Dinesh is a leader and fundraiser for the Armed Islamic Group, or GIA, one of the most violent factions of Algerian rebel extremists. A witness to the July 25th bomb explosion in Paris identified Dinesh as being at the scene. Police in Sweden, where Dinesh has lived for the past 2 years, say they believe he was in Stockholm on the day of the bombing. But they have kept Dinesh in custody and will probably comply with the extradition. French police now say the 2 exploded Paris bombs, which killed 7 people and injured more than 100, were the same type as an unexploded bomb found last weekend next to a railroad track. Police were forced to evacuate a train in Paris because of a false bomb scare, one of hundreds of false alerts in the past several weeks. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Schumann in Paris.
Government safety officials say they're keeping a taped crash test involving Chrysler minivans a secret. The National Highway Transportation Safety Board says it'll release the tapes in October. A spokesman says releasing it now might stir up public prejudice, and that could taint a case against the automaker. Consumers, or rather a consulting firm that works for lawyers who sue automakers, says unless the tape is made public, consumers might not be fully aware of the danger. Chrysler plans to replace automatic release mechanisms and the rear hatch latches in its minivans to strengthen them. There are fears the latches could pop open in crashes. Public files show at least 35 people have died in such crashes. Authorities in Houston took passengers off a Southwest Airlines jet today after a woman told a ticket agent she had guns and a bomb. Dogs sniffed the jet. The woman's been taken into custody. A Houston police spokesman says the woman was only joking. The flight was headed for New Orleans. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. He's worked with poor inner-city children for about 20 years. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. One of the programs he helped create teaches children how to avoid violence through conflict resolution. Canada also teaches children how to defend themselves with the martial art of taekwondo. Self-defense is something he had to learn growing up in the South Bronx. Canada has written a new book called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. You know, you are so able to defend yourself and so comprehending of the causes for violence and why children carry guns and everything, but that doesn't mean that your family is protected from all of this. Your book tells a really horrible story that your fiancé's nephew was shot and killed.
You know, it was probably for me one of the more devastating things that's happened in my life. This young person, he's a young man with a family, just standing on a street corner in Central Harlem on a corner that I go to on a regular basis. And there was a kid who came out and he was trying to kill somebody right next to Alex and shot several times and really shot the kid up five or six times in the head. And one bullet, just one bullet, missed this kid and hit my nephew. And, you know, when we got the call, it was so devastating because my fiance, Yvonne, when she told me that they had shot Alex, I was driving over to the emergency room and I was really, I said, you know, this guy, he was a handsome, big human being, strong, strapping young man. I said, the chances of one bullet killing him are just about nil. It hit him in his body. It didn't hit him in his head. I said, so don't be so upset thinking that Alex is dead. We got to the hospital, and the moment we pulled up, when I saw Alex's wife and I saw the other guys who were his best friend, I could tell that he was dead. And I just couldn't believe it. It was just stunning to me that just for no reason at all, made no sense, a young man like that could be killed. And it's happening all over this country all the time. And you know, the thing that I think, and it's probably, I mean, I worry about this. What really bothered me was it could have just as easily have been me. I mean, it was absolutely no reason I'm on that corner. It was absolutely no reason it was Alex versus anybody else. It seems to me that really shook me up. And it took me quite some time to really get over the fact of how at risk we all are because of handguns. This is just an issue of handguns being out of control and people using them, and it puts us all at risk.
Did you know the person who shot your nephew?
No. You know, we only heard through the grapevine that it was someone from further downtown than Central Harlem, but I didn't know the person, and as best I know, no one's ever been prosecuted for that murder.
Jeffrey Canada is my guest, and he's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, and the author of a new memoir called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. How much belief do you have in the system? In your memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, you write about how when you were young, your brother went to the grocery store, brought back change from the $10 bill that he was given. He got robbed, and your family couldn't afford to lose the $10. Your mother called the police. Two police show up. They don't do anything. This didn't seem very dramatic to them. They didn't care. It went nowhere. They didn't even take it seriously. And you say you lost your confidence in the police right then and there. Did you ever get it back?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the answer to that is no. And people sometimes ask me, well, Jeff, don't you think that in your community that's, you know, has a lot of crime, you certainly need police? And the answer is absolutely yes. We do need police. We do need folks who are there to protect the community. But we need people who are sensitive to the community, people who care about the community. You know, the problem with a lot of the police in inner city communities is that they're not from those communities. They just don't understand how those communities work. What they see is a kaleidoscope of the worst side of those communities, and they really believe that everybody in these communities are capable of anything. So they tend to treat those who are guilty of crimes and those who aren't guilty of crimes exactly the same way. And so it's very frustrating for those of us who live in the community to often have the police treating us as if we're the criminals. And it just really, I think, frustrates many citizens who believe that even when they do come, they honestly don't care. So we do need police, but we need police who care about the people there, who really feel that this is their community and they should be protecting it. Unfortunately, you know, the closer you are to these issues, the clearer it is to see that police are often acting in concert with many of the criminal elements. I live in the 30th precinct, which had a huge scandal for police who were involved in the drug sales and all kinds of crimes. And it's not uncommon. And, you know, every 4 or 5 years, they have some big scandal in the police department. Let me just tell you very quickly one of the real dangers with this. People know that there are certain members of the police forces which were involved in actually selling drugs. So if you called in a complaint against a drug dealer, we were all afraid that these police who were crooked inside the police force would tell this confidential source who you were and where you live. So people just felt they couldn't respond. And so that's the kind of, I think, lack of confidence in a police system that allows citizens not to really get involved in helping to make their own community safer by cooperating with police.
What do you tell young people when they have no respect for the police?
Well, I there are two things that I think that I tell them. I suggest a lot of our young people join the police force, and that seems sort of contradictory. But I think that if you really care about your community, then this is a way to serve the community. And it certainly should be something that young people should be encouraged to really go into the service areas of their community. The other thing, though, that I try and make it clear to young people that no one's perfect, but neither can you tar everybody with the same brush. We've made it a point, as a matter of fact, to know good beat officers. We get to know them. We develop a relationship with them. So we can say, you know what, don't go to anybody. But we know Officer Flowers, who happens to be this terrific officer here in New York. And him you can trust. He'll take it seriously. We know he's a straight guy. And it allows young people to understand that while you can be somewhat cynical, you shouldn't become a total cynic. There are people in every police force who are good, hardworking police officers who we can have relationships with, which will actually help you when you need them. Because, you know, you can have some very strong feelings about police, but let something happen and that you need a police officer and you want someone there who cares about your issue and is going to respond to it.
My guest is Jeffrey Canada, president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Canada, author of Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. I asked him if he agrees with those who accuse rap music and action films of inspiring young people to behave violently.
You know, this is one of those issues, again, that I talk about in the book. And I think that gangster rap in particular, and I think we have to really separate rap from gangster rap, which gangster rap is really the hardest rap. It tends to be very violent, and explicitly negative towards women. And many of us find it really distasteful. And a lot of us have been fighting with the music industry for them to clean up this area of music. But what I've cautioned people with is that while we attack rap music, we let people like Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger and these other people who make their living off of bringing mega violence into our communities. We teach our young people to act violently, and the media is totally irresponsible in this. But it's not just rap music. It's all across the board when it comes to media. And I think that we have to tackle this issue mainstream, all of the mainstream movies, the mainstream record industry, the mainstream video industry, as well as the areas like gangster rap, which I think are as vile as the others, but not more vile. They are as vile.
What would you like to see the industry do?
I think that this industry really has to tone this down. That they have to, first of all, like the cigarette companies have never done, they have to admit that what they put on the airwaves, over the airwaves, actually impacts children. That actually does cause young people to act more violently. It's not the sole determinant of young people acting violently. I'm the first one to say there are lots of reasons driving this issue, but it certainly contributes to it, because the end message is always, you know, there's a point where you can't take it anymore, that you punch back, or you kick back, or you shoot back, and in the end, you'll be a hero. And that message comes from cartoons to major Hollywood studio productions. Even the most mild person, when pushed too far, ends up acting violently. I used to like to tell people about Mighty Mouse. You know, I hated mice because we had them all the time. But here it was, you know, these poor mice would be so tormented by this cat that after a while you couldn't wait for Mighty Mouse to come and beat this cat up. Well, it taught us that, you know, there was a point that when you were pushed, you needed to act violently to respond. And that was totally justified. We teach our youngest child that, and it gets reinforced all the way up the line. All of us have to act more responsibly, and the media certainly should play a role in doing that. And I don't think they ought to be censored, but I think many of us as parents can censor the media by making sure that we actually listen to what our children are listening to on those CDs, that we actually watch the same shows they watch when they watch videos and all the other movies they watch, and we begin to say to them, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that's bad. You should never let anyone talk about a woman that way. You should never let anyone say those kinds of things to you. One of the things that I heard, which impressed me so much, someone said, if someone walked into your living room and began to curse and say these horrible things about women and swear and do all of this stuff about murder and stuff, you would kick them out. But we allow this stuff to come into our living rooms every day, and our children have access to this, and we're not even having a conversation with our children about these kinds of issues. So I think lots of families have to get involved in this, but the media is responsible, and they have to admit that this stuff does have an impact.
In your memoir, you write that the only way to turn things around in America is for adults to start standing side by side with children in the war zones. What do you recommend exactly? I mean, what...
This is a, I think that's really a critical question, because, many times this violence happens and we don't see it. We don't know where it is. We don't hear about it. Our minister once said that he spoke to a drug dealer, and the drug dealer asked him, he asked the drug dealer, why are the children always coming to you and they won't come to me? And the drug dealer told the minister, because I'm there when they need me. They can't find you. If they need somebody at 10 o'clock at night, guess what? You're home in bed. I'm there on the corner. The young people come to me. We have to change that dynamic. We have to make sure that we're there when the children need us. That if there's an issue, they know of an adult that they can go to and say, you know what? Someone's out to get me. Or I'm worried about this. Or I need some help. When we're not there, it gives the young person no one to turn to, except those negative role models who tend to be the major players in our young people's lives. We as adults have to become those major players again.
One last question for you. Do you think one of the reasons why you've been able to work with young people in teaching them how to avoid violence and teaching them how to resolve conflicts without resorting to violence, do you think the reason why you can do that is because you can defend yourself, because you're physically strong, because you know how to fight, because you know martial arts?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it's one of the things that got me really so fascinated by this issue of violence, because I recognize that many of the young people who were coming to me really were coming to me out of fear. But I'll tell you this, you don't have to be a martial artist to really be a role model to young people. What young people really crave are adults who are there, who care about them, and who have some power. It's not physical power. As I say, I don't fight. I haven't beaten anybody up. I don't threaten children. I know if children are in a problem, I don't go in and say, well, I'll go beat the person up for you. Children want someone who can say, you know the kind of power I have? Let me make a call. Let me be the one. You having a problem in school? I'll go there with you, and I'll talk to the teacher. What happened? Okay, let me go by your house. I'll talk with your mother. We'll see if we can straighten this out. This is the kind of personal power that young people need. You know, you want to go see that movie and you don't have any money? Come on, you can come with me when I take my child there. That's the kind of relationships that I think children really are looking for. When you're there, when children really need you, it makes it easier for you to get the kinds of messages. You know, we transmit our cultural values through interaction. And if we don't interact with children, we can't sit around as adults and say, you know, goodness, I don't know what's happening to the moral fabric of this society. I don't know what's happening to our cultural mores and our values. The children don't seem to carry them. Well, the children don't carry them because we were not there to pass them down. That is an active process, not a passive one. So the way you pass down those values and the way you pass down those morals is you spend a lot of time with children and they learn it from what you do, not from what you say. So my real push for this country is that we have to get reinvolved and reconnected with our children and give them an opportunity to see us in a variety of different roles as human beings and adults, and therefore to learn to mimic what we do and to model what we do and have a chance and an opportunity to see us as human beings who care about them and are part of their lives.
Jeffrey Canada, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Terry.
Jeffrey Canada is the president of the Riedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. He's the author of the memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. Our interview was recorded in June. This is Fresh Air. At the O.J. Simpson trial today, the defense played excerpts of the Mark Furman tapes. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have that story, Terry. Interviews by a screenwriter with Los Angeles police officer Mark Furman are being played in court. Judge Ito is deciding whether to allow the jury to hear the tapes. The tapes contain various racial slurs. Cheryl Duvall reports from Chicago about complaints that two black-owned banks are being taken over by a larger white-owned bank. NPR's Dan Charles reports the Securities and Exchange Commission has decided to make all the information it has about companies available online. And Donald McCaig has some thoughts about the lack of an information superhighway out where he lives in Western Virginia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of Dave Bartholomew, an arranger and producer who Ed says helped shape the sound of New Orleans rock and roll.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Is that a shame?
For those even casually aware of such things, Fats Domino personifies the New Orleans sound of rock and roll. Yet, if you look at the labels of his records, you'll notice that nearly all of them are credited to Domino Bartholomew. And herein lies a clue to the existence of one of the most underknown figures in all of rock and roll history, Dave Bartholomew. Bartholomew was born around 1920, and around 1930, he began taking trumpet lessons from Peter Davis, the man who taught Louis Armstrong. 2 years later, Bartholomew's father, a barber who played tuba in local bands, was taking his boy to his gigs, and before long, the kid was playing at them, which led to his employment after high school on the SS Capital, a riverboat that had Fats Pichon's band in residence. Pichon soon left for Bourbon Street and turned the band over to the teenager to lead. After a stint in the Army, where he learned to write music and make arrangements, he returned to New Orleans and put together the band that would make history.
I'm going home, yes, going home. Spend the rest of my life, man with my wife. Ain't roaming no more with Mo and Joe. Oh no, I ain't gonna do it.
In 1949, Lou Chudd, who owned a new label called Imperial, caught the band at a week-long gig in Houston and asked Bartholomew if he'd like to record artists for the label in New Orleans. Bartholomew had been keeping track of the local talent and immediately cut two records. The first was Jewel King's 3x7 is 21, a top 10 rhythm and blues hit, and the second was even bigger than that.
I was standing on the corner, all around.
Fats Domino's The Fat Man may have sold over 1 million copies in 1950, although nobody was keeping track back then, and it put Imperial, Fats, and Dave Bartholomew on the map. Fats remained the bandleader's meal ticket, although he continued to record other New Orleans artists. Ironically, one of the biggest hits he was associated with came during a brief falling out with Chud.
Oh, now, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia, girl, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't be me. Because I give you.
Bartholomew arranged and produced Lloyd Price's smash hit. Fats played piano on it, and his own current release wound up trailing it up the charts. Around this time, Bartholomew also produced Shirley and Lee for Aladdin Records, starting them on a string of hits that lasted for over 5 years.
Cause your love is mine. Ooh, baby.
EMI's 1992 anthology of Dave Bartholomew's productions covers his whole career with Imperial, which lasted until 1963 when Chud sold the label. It's a cross-section of New Orleans during the 50s, with everyone from the Neville Brothers' first group, the Hawks, to the ill-fated Smiley Lewis, to the undeservedly obscure James Sugarboy Crawford.
Got a big fat mama, yeah, I got a big fat mama, yeah, I got a big fat mama, yeah, a long lean galley was truly squat, 310 pounds, yeah, 310 pounds, yeah, 310 pounds.
What links all of these records together is the Bartholomew Band, which featured the rhythm section of bassist Frank Fields and drummer Earl Palmer, who together virtually invented black rock and roll. And, although in an interview with journalist Adam Block, Bartholomew denied there was such a thing, the other common feature is the sound of New Orleans, which Bartholomew brought to all of America and the world.
Ed Ward is living in Berlin, where he writes about rock music. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shura, with Nancy Updike and Alan Tu, who directed today's show. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, language instruction at home or on the go with Living Language. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series on young people and the epidemic of urban violence. We'll hear from Father Greg Boyle, a priest who works with Latino gangs in L.A. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.